Let me set the scene for you. You're in a quiet neighborhood near the beach at Dash Point, which is just north of Tacoma, and the sun is setting. It's just about to kiss the horizon, and then out comes 81-year-old Don Britton onto his porch. Britton does this every night, exactly at dusk, and he's been doing it for like 5 years. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this haunting sunset ritual is kicking off our show about life after dark. So Britton says playing taps every night occurred to him when he saw a 9/11 tribute, and he wanted to find his own way to honor the military service members.
These folks are out there giving their life for us so we can be here, be safe. And I thought, that by itself, for me, is inspiration enough for me to go out, and if I can play and contribute to what they're doing, that's enough for me.
Don was never in the military himself. He had a childhood bout of polio that kept him from serving. But he says these clockwork performances have touched people, and he gets letters from service members, people as far away as Afghanistan. When he started doing this in 2010, he wasn't really sure he was going to keep it up for this long, but he says his wife really pushed him.
I lost my wife a few years ago, and she was supportive of it from day one, and at times I'd get a little lazy and say, I don't think I'm going to go out here and play tonight or something, and she'd say, you get your butt out there and you go play. She was tough. She was tough. To be able to kind of bury myself in the music helped me get past the loss, I think. Just helped me get past that.
So I don't know how you'd feel about your neighbor blowing a trumpet every night at dusk, but Britton's neighbors seem to love it. Every concert ends in applause.
I came a little bit of a minor hero here. Not intentionally, but because they seem to enjoy it. It's almost embarrassing a little bit to me that I've gotten so much positive feedback and so many accolades. That was my intent. I just thought, if I come out here and do this, it makes me feel good. It's simplistic. It's not complicated.
Now, imagine the sun just sinking below the horizon, and the light fades, and I think we're ready for a sound effect after dark. Here we go. For our first story of After Dark, I am joined by sound effects senior producer Arwen Nix. Hey, Arwen.
Hello, Gabriel. So this next story is about being on call in the middle of the night, after dark.
Okay, on call, like a doctor or someone's going to deliver babies.
Sure, sure. Like a doctor or a paramedic or a firefighter or the police.
Right, but those people are kind of always on call, right?
Yeah, in a way, they're always on call, but I'd say that the game has really changed after dark. I mean, imagine that you've fallen asleep, you're warm in your bed, and then all of a sudden the phone rings and you have to spring into action. You got to be at the top of your game.
Can I have 5 more minutes?
See, exactly. So waking up in the middle of the night is not an easy thing. And there's a group of people that do that after dark that you might not have ever thought of. Public defenders.
Public defender, like you're talking about lawyers.
Yeah, attorneys, public prosecutors, public defenders. And in the Office of Public Defense, one thing that makes this possible is this phone that gets passed from lawyer to lawyer in shifts. It'll ring all through the night with calls from the public that need defense.
So is this all the time or is it kind of once in a while? Like how often are they in this position?
So the phone exists all the time, but any individual lawyer in the Office of Public Defense is not going to have it more than twice a year. And the shifts that they have this phone for are either going to be a weekend long or the entire week.
Okay. So they're sort of spending a weekend or a full week with this bat phone thingy.
Yes, exactly. When I first heard about this, that's exactly what I called it. I called it the bat phone because it sounded cool to me, you know, like this red phone that could get you to a lawyer. But in the Office of Public Defense, there was this communications manager that I spoke to, and she had a much, much better name for it. She called it the murder phone.
Some people have been calling it the murder phone. I'd never heard it been called that by anybody, quite frankly, who's ever done it.
Okay, so who is that? Is that someone who's actually done it?
Yeah, it is. That is Ben Goldsmith. He's a public defender. He's been a public defender here in Seattle for more than a decade. And he and all of the other lawyers that I spoke to, they never called it the murder phone. They called it the beeper phone because long before the millennials were ever born, it was a pager that you would wear probably on your belt. And most often they call it attorney of the week.
Oh, it's kind of like a prize.
Right? Doesn't it sound like that?
That's definitely the joke I made to my parents the first couple of times I did it, as in, hey, I'm attorney of the week. But no, you don't feel like you're winning something. You feel like if you're winning anything, you're winning probably some interrupted night's sleep.
Congratulations.
I know.
So who calls the phone?
All right. I'll let another public defender, Jesse Dubow, answer that question.
It's for a couple of things for people who need legal advice off hours, essentially. So primarily anyone stopped for a DUI any time of day, although obviously DUIs are obvious mostly at night, who need legal advice on whether to blow into the breathalyzer, whether to give a breath sample or not, and they want to talk to a lawyer before they make that decision. We also get calls for anyone accused or arrested on a homicide. And once they're booked into the jail automatically calls the phone and a lawyer comes down and talks to the suspect, the client.
There's the murder phone epithet. I mean, we are talking, this is life and death.
This is homicide that these people are being taken in for charges of homicide or attempted homicide. And when someone is serving as attorney of the week, they don't know what the call is going to be. Like, it could be a DUI, but maybe not. So I asked Jesse about the first time he had the beeper phone. It was just this last 4th of July weekend.
I sent my wife and kids to my in-laws, so I wouldn't wake them up. Although they're 4-month-old, we were probably up a lot anyway. So it wasn't easy for us. And yeah, just made sure the phone was on high so I didn't sleep through it.
What were you thinking when the phone first rang, when you first heard it?
Sort of exciting because you don't know what it's going to be. It could be a homicide, it could be a DUI, you have just no idea. So there's that, and you pick up the phone and you don't know what you're going to open in that door.
Wow, yeah. So you kind of have to be on your toes, right? Because you never know when it's going to be something really serious. And what happens when they get a call and it is something really serious, like a homicide?
Well, that depends on when they get the call. If the jail calls, they go down to the jail and they meet with the client. And that interaction is very different. They don't have the stacks of files and the info on what happened or supposedly happened. They don't have evidence to go through. They have, well, basically nothing. They know the charge and they have to get up to speed as fast as they possibly can. And that can be pretty rough.
If you were a doctor and you're trying to make a diagnosis with 15% of the information that you'd ordinarily have.
Okay, so anytime someone's arrested for homicide or attempted homicide, this phone, this murder phone, this
Beeper phone
rings.
No.
No. No?
No. You could be arrested. You could be questioned. All of those things could happen before the phone ever gets a call.
Okay, but the point of this is that you have a right to an attorney, right? I mean, and that's right there in the Miranda rights. You have a right to an attorney.
Yes, it is in the Miranda rights. But even in the version that says, if you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided for you, it doesn't say, and hey, let me get that guy on the phone right now.
Well, okay, so we're finding the boundaries of your civil rights here. But when does the phone actually ring?
You have to be very explicit. Like, when I say very, I mean the most explicit.
If I say,
is this on a homicide case?
On a homicide case, if I get brought in, if you get, you know, you haven't gotten the call in the middle of the night yet, but I have been taken into custody, and I say, I have a right to an attorney. Mm-hmm. Does that get a lawyer called?
No, I don't think so.
If I say, where's my attorney?
That would probably cease the interrogation. I don't think that would necessarily get a call to me, but that would CC interrogation, if it was a homicide, you'd be brought to the jail, and then I would come down and talk to you.
So if I say, I am not speaking anymore until I can speak to my attorney, that would get you called?
That would still probably just get the interrogation ceased and you brought to the jail. If you really wanted to continue with the interrogation and have an attorney present, you'd probably have to say something to the effect of, no, I really do want to talk to you guys, or I'm really seriously considering talking to you guys, but I need to talk to an attorney first. So please don't take me to jail. I may tell you exactly what you need to hear, but I need to talk to an attorney first.
Gosh, it's like it's a miracle this phone ever rings at all.
I know. But it does. It rings a lot. And the thing that you have to understand is that though there may be all this time that passes between when someone gets taken in as a suspect and when the phone rings, as soon as that person is brought to the jail and booked, the jail will call. If the detectives do not call, if you are not explicit and say, this is what I want exactly, by the time you get to the jail will always make the phone call.
So you know what I like about this is that it evokes this idea that there are these guardians of our constitutional rights that are perpetually on call and on hair trigger for when we need them. I mean, you don't think about them. You think about the cops and robbers in this little film noir. But in your film, there's also these lawyers who are there ready to kind of take the graveyard shift of upholding our civil rights.
Right. My film is like a weird indie noir film with a very unexpected perspective on what happens after dark.
And a lot of bureaucracy.
A lot of briefcases, maybe.
So it's a bureaucracy and all. I kind of like this movie. I'm kind of glad that they exist.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful to know that no matter day or after dark, that you can have access to public defense. That's wonderful. But I don't know. I hope that no one in our listening audience ever has to make this phone ring.
Senior producer Arwin Nix, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gabriel.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're devoting our show to the theme of After Dark. And if you've ever been a little kid, which most of us have, you might have had this experience of being afraid of the dark, or being nervous around the dark, or thinking about the animals or creatures or monsters that might be lurking under your bed or in your closet. Well, somebody probably told you at some point that that is all foolishness, and that you should probably just outgrow it. Well, my guest now has a slightly different message, and I'm going to ask him to explain it to us as we get into it. His name is Gordon Oriens. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Washington, and he's the author, among other things, of Snakes, Sunrises, and Shakespeare, How Evolution Shapes Our Loves and Fears. Hey, welcome to Sound Effect, Dr. Oriens.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't we start by going back a few tens of thousands of years. What would nightfall have been like for our hunter-gatherer ancestors?
Of course, our hunter-gatherer ancestors had no electricity, no other sources of light. And when darkness fell, they were in the darkness as it fell. And our ancestors, like ourselves, were diurnal animals. We are very good at during the daylight. We see colors very well, but we see very poorly at night, and therefore we are very vulnerable at night. And moreover, the major predators that our ancestors faced were primarily nocturnal hunters, so it was very dangerous to be out when they could see well and you couldn't. So like all other primates, with the one exception, namely male gorillas, all other primates either sleep in trees at night or on cliff faces where the large predators can't get at them.
So this is complete speculation, of course, but do you have an idea of like what it might have felt like at that time if we were, in our ancient ancestors as the night fell?
Not too difficult to imagine how our ancestors would have felt, because I have felt that myself when I was working on the African savanna doing some research for the book. And when you see the light fading and the clouds coloring up, you realize you have about a half hour to get where you want to be at dark. And if you're out far in the savanna, you suddenly have apprehension.
So I guess I sort of thought of fear of the dark as being a kind of generic fear of like not being able to see, right? You don't, it's the same kind of fear that like walking through a dark room that you're going to bump into a wall.
Yeah.
But what sounds like what you're describing is deeper and more specific.
It's both specific and I think there's some general aspects to it as well. Certainly what originally primed this and I think is the fundamental driver is the approach of night and the importance of being in a safe place at night, which during much of our ancestry was fairly stringent in its requirements. And then we got to building fences and houses and fires and things like that. And nighttime didn't become so dangerous. But I think it was very deep and important. But as you imply, it expresses itself in other ways. I mean, not only our reaction to sunsets and why they're so compelling, that when you see the sky red up, you should not ignore it because in the tropics, the sun goes straight down. You have a half hour, none of this long twilight that we're used to here at high latitudes. You don't have much time. But also, during the day, we go from light to dark. And whereas during the day, we can adjust to going into darker places, it takes a while for our eyes to do that. So if we're walking from a light place toward a dark place, it's very dangerous and it's somewhat fearful. We find that as we approach a darker area, you tend to slow down. You wait right at the entrance for your eyes to adjust because if there's any danger in there, it can see you and you can't see it until your eyes adjust.
Why didn't we just develop better eyes, better night vision?
Well, there's a trade-off in how well you can see. We have excellent daytime vision. We have cones that are responsive to colors. We see color very well. This is extremely important for operating during the day. You could also build that in for with rods for seeing well at night, but then the eyes start getting bigger and bigger. I mean, it costs more to do all of this.
Oh, and it takes up space in your head.
It takes up space in the head. It's more expensive to maintain.
And when you're talking about trade-offs and something being expensive, yeah. I mean, you mean like it takes energy and resources in your body to kind of devote space and calories to making that happen.
That's exactly what I mean. The brain is very expensive. The brain is just a few percentage of our body weight. It consumes about a quarter of all the calories we burn. Thinking is really hard work. We get a lot from it, but there's always the need for an economy of packaging, and there's trade-offs as to if you were to put all that energy and structure into maintaining very, very large eyes that could see very well during both the day and at night, you'd have to sacrifice something else. And since our ancestors were able to get in safe places during the night and didn't have to go out, evolution did not favor eyes of that size and complexity.
And so instead we develop all these other kind of coping mechanisms. Do you think that it's we shouldn't tell our kids that it's silly or childish to be afraid of the dark?
We should never tell our kids that sort of thing is silly or foolish. You should try to explain to them why you have it.
And if a kid has a particular fear of a boogeyman or a monster under their bed or something like that, how do you read that through the evolutionary lens?
It's very interesting that in terms of dreams and the fear at night, well, we know quite a bit about this. And it turns out that when boys dream about boogeymen and dangers at night, they mostly dream about things coming laterally from the side. When girls dream about it, they're much more likely to dream about it coming from below. And the archaeological evidence indicates that our female ancestors retained a climbing morphology longer in our history than the males did. And also they were smaller and more vulnerable. So the evidence indicates that our female ancestors roosted at night in the trees longer than the males did. And this is reflected in the form of the dreams that people have today.
That's crazy. So there's evidence now that contemporarily, when girls and women have nightmares, the danger is coming more predominantly from below, and for boys and men, it's coming from the side, from,
exactly.
Coming straight at you. So when it comes to these kinds of fears and phobias and, I don't know if you'd call them irrational, but not exactly conscious emotions, how much of this stuff are we walking around with that really comes from tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago?
I think our minds are full of ghosts of environments past, as I like to call them. They're ghosts of predators past. They're ghosts of hostile conspecifics past. They're ghosts of volcanic eruptions past. They're ghosts of tsunamis past. The world out there is full of all sorts of dangers, and we have responses to them. And they're not rational in the sense that they're thought out. When you have a sudden appearance of a dangerous predator, the emotional response is immediate. It's not cognitive. And this makes sense because many of these decisions that our ancestors had to make out there had to be made very rapidly. You didn't have time to think a lot about them. If you pondered a long time, now, how hungry is this lion really? you're more likely end up as lion's dinner than if you said, I'm going to assume it's hungry and go, you know. I think the important lesson of evolutionary psychology is that most of these responses that we have evolved because they helped our ancestors in one way or another. They may not be equally helpful today, and some of them aren't, but you want to try to understand why we have them, where they came from, and to note that it's, you know, these are not just irrational things. That's not the way to think about them. The way to think about them is, how did they serve our ancestors? Then ask, how do they serve us now? And do we want to try to override some of them when we can, or do we just let them flow and enjoy them?
Well, Gordon Oriens is a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Washington, and his book, well, one of his books anyway, is Snakes, Sunrises, and Shakespeare, How Evolution Shapes Our Loves and Fears. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect, Gordon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So we've been talking about what night was like for our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Now, there are actually a number of places in the world where people still pretty much live like that. And one of them is in the Gran Chaco region of South America. And that's where the Tobaquam people live. Now, this is an indigenous group. They're actually scattered around in a few different settlements. And as UW psychology professor Horacio de la Iglesia was scouting around, and we're going to get to why he was doing that in a minute, he found at least two distinct groups. One was almost completely based on indigenous technology, meaning they had no electricity whatsoever. And the other lived a little bit closer to town, about 30 miles away, and that was close enough to have at least some reliable power. Most of the people in that second group had electric lights, and almost everybody had a TV. So here we have this very powerful natural experiment for a scientist. You have two groups of people, they're similar in almost every way, but there's one key difference: access to electricity. Now, that is something that de la Iglesia had been searching for decades. And the reason is this. He wanted to see how that access to electricity affects the thing that he studies most closely, sleep.
When we looked at the data that we got using these wearable devices that tell us very precisely when they walk to bed and when they wake up.
They're these bracelets.
These are bracelets, kind of like the Fitbit or those bracelets that people use now to count steps or how much they run, a little bit more sophisticated than those. And the other advantage is that they also measure the light exposure, so you get the two pieces of information. And it was really striking that in the community that had no electricity, all the people were going to bed at the same time and they were waking up at the very same time. And of course, this is because they were synchronized to the sunlight, and as soon as it was pitch dark, they were all sleeping, and as soon as there's a little bit of a hint of light in the morning, they're all up and ready to go.
And so the people with access to electricity, what was different about their sleep?
Well, their sleep is shorter by an hour, and all that depth in sleep, I mean an hour daily, of course, right? Which is a lot from a physiological point of view. You can actually show long-term effects of depriving somebody of an hour of sleep per day, and there's a cumulative effect in decreasing performance and learning deficits, other things that happen when you're sleep deprived. So that's the first thing that happened. And the other thing that it's pretty clear is that all the sleep deprivation comes from, so that hour that they're missing always comes from extending the evening, never from waking up earlier. In other words, and we kind of intuitively know we do the same here. You know, we're still waking up at sunrise, but we're going to bed in the winter in Seattle probably 5 to 6 hours later than whoever lived here, say, you know, a couple of hundred years ago. And that seems to be a common theme. What we've done with artificial light is extend the evening hours. And because we're still waking up at the very same time, we basically have shortened our sleep.
So these hunter-gatherers in remote Argentina are reenacting a really important transition that most of the world made hundreds of years ago, a fundamental change in the way we think of the nighttime hours. Sure, artificial light can make those dark hours safer, less likely to, you know, get you eaten by a leopard, but it also makes them more useful. And De La Iglesia explained how that transformed our culture and learning and really our whole society.
We were extremely efficient in dominating our night. I think that added a new meaning to the night. Suddenly the night, or at least portion of the night, was useful time. Not only to be more productive, like we have factories that work 24/7, but also to read, to cultivate yourself, right? To do a lot of things that were not possible, particularly in the northern latitudes where, you know, in a place like Seattle in the winter, you have only 8 hours of light. That must have been an amazing change to suddenly being able to control that winter and be able to socialize, to do other things that you couldn't do with just 8 hours of light. So I think in a way that's kind of the good side of the story. The bad side of the story is that I think any sleep expert would agree that we are overdoing it. We're overstimulating us by not only keeping the lights on in the evening, but now doing things that are overly stimulating and displaying levels of activity at nighttime that we should not be displaying. And that, of course, has long-term health effects. You know, sleep deprivation is epidemic in any industrialized society. It's a big problem. And it's all a consequence of our ability to control the night.
What got you so interested in this? And what is it about it that you find so fascinating, this idea of understanding the basic science behind our biological clocks and how we manipulate them?
Well, in a way, it started just by knowing more and more about the circadian system. Actually, when you study the evolution of the circadian system, which is essentially a set of biological clocks that are endogenous, they are in our body, and they can be synchronized. Typically, the main synchronizer of these clocks is the light-dark cycle. The circadian systems of all the organisms have become extremely sensitive to minute amounts of light. And this is even true for humans. I could dim the light that we are under now by 100 times, and that's still far more sufficient than the threshold to synchronize your circadian rhythm. So
like your little clock genes are turning on even in the tiny, tiny little flickers.
Exactly. Even
of
with
light.
Very tiny amounts of light, you can do that. So if you go to the bathroom, even if you have a dimmer and you turn a very dim light in the bathroom at night, that will stimulate your biological clock. And that's a message not to sleep, it's a message to resynchronize your clock. And knowing about this high sensitivity to very dim levels of light makes you realize that indeed artificial light must have had a tremendous impact in our sleep-wake cycle. And in fact, it has.
Does it ever make you want to move out of the city, out into the mountains somewhere? Because, I mean, you must have this, I mean, it must be just chronic all the time in the middle of an urban place that has all this artificial light everywhere. There's constantly, even
yes.
In a dark house.
Yeah, well, there are things that you can do to help prevent this, right? Now we know, for instance, that the wavelength to which the circadian system is most sensitive is blue light. So one thing you can do is in the evening avoid exposure to blue light. There's even apps now that will filter the blue light from your screen after whatever time you want.
Do you use this?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Well, I'm learning all kinds of ways in which I'm doing sleep wrong, so thanks for that. Horacio de la Iglesia is a professor of biology at the University of Washington, and his recent study of sleep in an Argentinian hunter-gatherer society was published in the Journal of Biological Rhythms. Hey, thanks so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We are out after dark this week. And for those of us who actually do sleep during the dark hours in the morning, you might notice that a familiar wall or sign or stretch of sidewalk has changed. Graffiti has popped up like mushrooms under the moonlight. Pictures and inscrutable tags done in spray paint or permanent marker. And you can't help but notice them, but you'll probably never get quite as intimate with them as the people whose job it is to cover them up. Sound Effect's Bree Ripley has the story.
There's graffiti all over Seattle.
If the graffiti taggers stopped tagging, would you guys still have a job?
Probably not. I don't think so. You know, if there's no tags, I don't know that we'd have. Maybe we'd have something else to do, but I don't think it'll ever stop. I mean, it'll always be somewhere.
Probably not, or maybe do as a painter, you know, different department.
That's Kevin Roth and Ziggy Kaminsky. They're two of the Seattle Graffiti Rangers, a small division of Seattle Public Utilities. And all the paint that goes up after dark, it's their job to cover it up at dawn.
You see, it comes off pretty easy.
The city of Seattle spends around $1 million each year covering up graffiti. And Kevin and Ziggy are two of the five Seattle Graffiti Rangers that do that work. And when I went out with them at 7:30 a.m. on a Thursday, I watched them do what they do Monday through Friday, hunt for graffiti.
And this is why we walk around the whole thing, because, you know, again, we missed it.
And sometimes the easiest way to cover up spray paint is with spray paint.
It's been spray painted before. Obviously, somebody's come through and done it in the past. So sometimes it's quicker and easier and less cost. It's cost effective to do it that way. The quicker you remove it, more likely they won't come back. You know, if you keep covering it up, chances are they get tired of coming back.
There are different types of graffiti. Most commonly, there are tags, which are those small inscriptions or slogans that you see on the sides of mailboxes or trash cans. And then there are pieces, which are larger and more colorful, most commonly seen on the sides of trains or buildings. But for some people, vandalism is vandalism, and graffiti is associated with gangs. Seattle has had its ups and downs in gang-related activity since the 1980s, but gang-related graffiti is the minority of what is being covered up.
How much of this do you think is gang graffiti?
1%, not the most.
Can you say that again?
1% maybe. I would say 1%, just 1%. It's not much at all.
So if the gross majority of all these tags and pieces are not linked to gangs, I asked Ziggy and Kevin what they think the purpose of all this graffiti is.
I think they just want to be seen. I think they want something that they've done to be seen, you know, and I think it's more for just, you know, hey, look at me.
If just the thrill of it, you know, just you see all the tags right above the canal, you know, on Aurora. I mean, it's very dangerous to get up there and just to put a few ladders on top of the bridge right above the water. They risk their lives, but just for the thrill and to be seen, yeah. So.
As we drive around the city, we haul around a few rollers, more than 20 buckets of paint, and a few small pails of chemicals. They're outfitted in white painter's pants and bright orange t-shirts for safety, though traffic isn't the only hazard.
You really gotta be careful where you walk, because there's a lot of this stuff here.
Oh, needles.
You know, and human waste. That's been a problem.
It's hard work. I was surprised to learn that Kevin and Ziggy don't hate graffiti. They just wish it was done legally.
give them a certain area or give them a wall that they can do, you know, and let them, you know, make it legal for them to do it. But when it's illegal and it's you're destroying property, it costs a lot of money to fix it. You know, a building owner, it's going to cost him thousands of dollars to restore his brick or whatever was tagged. Sometimes they etch glass.
Ziggy and Kevin have gone so far as to document some of the pieces they've covered. As we stood under the Airport Way Bridge in Georgetown, Ziggy swiped through picture after picture on his phone, showing me some of his favorite pieces of graffiti that he's covered up.
The sad thing is that some of the graffitis are beautiful and we still have to cover up because they don't have permission.
They joked about compiling a coffee table book or a calendar with themselves on the cover. They appreciate some of the work, though they don't love all of it.
I mean, you have artwork and then you have destruction. You know, something that makes no sense.
But no matter how beautiful or destructive the graffiti is that goes up at night, all of it has to be covered up. It could be argued that graffiti was the first written communication. Cave art. So it's unlikely that it will be going away anytime soon. And for Kevin and Ziggy, at least that's some solid job security.
We heading out?
Yeah, we can jump in. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's good.
That story from Sound Effects' Bree Ripley. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestead. Thanks to producer Matthew Stribe for our Taps segment. Intern Bree Ripley contributed this week. We had web help from Michael Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can find our podcast on iTunes. You can subscribe there. And if you can spare a lousy stinking minute, you can write us a short review.
Gabriel?
He is.
Hi. So Arwen Nix, senior producer, just for those listening. If you could go to the iTunes store, I will write you a personal letter of thank you if you just go in there and subscribe and rate us for a minute, because the way that works is the more people who fill out that little star chart, the more people that can find the show. As a personal favor, dear strangers, please do this.
So Arwen will write you a letter of thanks if you write a review. I will come and flick you on the ear if you don't.
I mean it, though. If you write a review, send me a screenshot, and then send me your address, I will write you a thank you note. I would appreciate it. All right, back to you.
Thank you. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org if you want to do this in a little lower impact way. No letter guaranteed for that one. You can tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. Hey, we'll see you here next week when the clock will be ticking.
When it starts working for the first time, that's the best feeling I think anybody could ever experience. It's like knowing that something has sat silent for, you know, 50 years or even longer maybe, and then to have the privilege of hearing it sing once again, I mean, for you, is just, it's phenomenal.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.